Sicher schon mit Partment da.
Oh, good afternoon, yes. Good afternoon. I think it's 10 o'clock now.
Today we are going to deliberate on the bill. I was requested by the committee to converse with the minister about our view that the constitution should be removed from the bill, and the minister did not have a problem with that. We requested the legal services of the department and the parliament and the state law advisors to process amendments to the bill in the context of that proposal advanced by the committee. And I think they've been working very hard on this. I should say that we also received the written comments by Honorable Van der Westhuizen in relation to aspects of the bill. And I've noted that those comments which related to the Constitution would therefore be referred to the Ministry for consideration in the context of the process of finalizing the Constitution separate from the bill. I'm going to afford the opportunity to the department to then lead the process of how they concluded the process of finalizing the bill. And I would allow them to introduce themselves as they speak. And then members should also do the same when they engage with the proposals.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Eva Bosov. I'm from the Department of Higher Education and Training. Chair, as you've already indicated, the three sets of lawyers did, or legal advisors did get together. We've worked together on a joint proposal, which was sent through to the secretary of the committee on Thursday. Chair, what was very important is that we've dealt with three very important issues. The first one is to deal with the position that was put by the committee to remove the schedule and therefore look at consequential amendments as a result of that. The second one was to look at the mistakes that have been referred to in the legislation and to make sure that we can deal with that. And then, Chair, lastly, actually it should have been the second point, but it is also to make sure that we strengthen the legislation in order to provide the same outcome to the minister when dealing with the regulations, when Schedule 5 is removed from the bill. Chair, the proposal that we've got on the table, as I indicated, is an effort which came from all of us, all the legal advisors. Chair, the approach we've taken in order to strengthen the legislation is, first of all, the references to the minister approving the constitution is not the acceptable route anymore. If it was a constitution that's part of the legislation, then the minister would approve in order to make sure that it is in line with it. But with the approach of the minister making the regulations, the approach is rather for the minister then to provide, through the regulations, a constitution to the specific institution or a CETA. And therefore, Clause 6 is merely correcting the word approve and amended to provide the constitution. Clause 8 is dealing with the typographical error, with the reference has been to the Act of 3002, which should be 2002. That's just a technical amendment. Clause 9 is dealing with, once again, the issues that's been discussed in the committee. It is an aspect which the committee must carefully consider, in the sense that currently the provision is that the clause provides that there must be six members or representatives appointed by organized labor, six from labor, and two through a four categories nomination that the minister will then determine the membership in terms of the category or the criteria listed in the Act. So the approach there was to say, why must it be a fixed number? If it is less than that, why can't it be less than that number? And the proposal that we've put on the table is to say, instead of must be, if you look at the wording of Clause 9, which is an amendment to Section 11, and there is a copy that the Parliamentary Law Advisor also made available to see where it fits into the Act itself, just for easy reference. Then it is, instead of say that the members referred to in paragraph A, that's the members of this accounting authority, must include those categories and the numbers, it is just to amend it to say may not include more than. So it can be less than, but not more than. So it's not changing anything. It can still be a 6-6 and 2, 14 in total. But if there is a very small CITO which don't need 14 members, but need whatever amount, and the equality aspect is still provided for. So the next issue that's been dealt with is the reference that is also in the same clause, which is dealing in subsection or subclause 5, where there is the listing of the different category of role players or stakeholders as listed in Annex 4 of the Constitution. Here, there is no Constitution a schedule to the Act, and therefore we had to remove that. So what the listing will still be in the Constitution, but we can't prescribe how the minister will structure the Constitution. So it is a consequence of the discussion. Here, the next amendment is to Clause 11. That is on page 7 of the bill. So once again, there is a inclusion of the current Section 13 if the amendment's been accepted to assist the members to get how it fits into the framework. So what we've got there is, first of all, it is in line with what we've done in Clause 9, or Section Clause 6, where we dealt with Section 9, is the minister not to approve the constitution, but to provide the constitution through the regulations. Chair, the next issue is that we've also provided that it is a constitution that is prescribed by the minister, and it is then also dealing with the reference in subclause 2, where the current bill is referring to as contained in Schedule 5. We've deleted that and to just refer to the standard constitution as referred to in subsection 1. The issues pertaining to to the next one that we're dealing in line six, which is in line seven, which is the start of subsection two. This is a new subsection two that we propose, and that is to deal with all the issues that the minister must address within the constitution. It is important that if subordinate legislation is provided, that there is a guiding framework provided by the original legislation to assist the structure and format of it. And that is what we've done here. It is to provide the basic aspects that would be necessary in a constitution, and it also strengthens the minister's position by providing for that specific aspect in the regulations at the time he promulgates the regulations. So what we've got there is basically identify the key issues in the constitution, and we've listed them according to how it is in our view part of a valid constitution of an organization of this nature. Chair, I don't know if it's necessary to go through each one of them. I'm sure the members looked at it, but Chair, that is also part of our mandate to strengthen the legislation by taking out that schedule. Chair, and then lastly, it is once again a consequential change, which is dealing with aspect of as is contained in Schedule 5, which is not there anymore, and the constitution we refer to is the constitution as is by regulation as contemplated or referred to in section or subsection 1. So the next issue that we are then addressing is once again consequential. The reference that one would find in the current clause 11, and that is in the current sub 3, and which is referring to subsection 2. Because there's now a new subsection 2, one must now refer to the new subsection 3, and therefore there is two references that is as a result of the renumbering that we've corrected. And then the other issue was also raised in clause 11, the amendment to section 13 sub 4c, which is referring to an essential deviation. The word essential we've deleted. If one of the members raised the question, what's the value of that? And after fair consideration, we were of the opinion that there's no real added value to it. That is the amendments that we propose to clause 11. Then there is a rejection of clause 28. That is the one dealing with the schedule. And then clause 30, which is the transitional arrangements. Once again, it's consequential issues that we must deal with. And first of all, it is the reference, once again, that we've taken out in sub clause 30. Sub 3, where it is referring to Schedule 5, we've taken that out and obviously referred to Section 13.1 of the Act. Then we've also dealt with the references, which is not 13.2 anymore, but it's now 13.3. There's three of those references that we had to correct it. And then lastly, it is dealing with the alignment because there's three options, as you can remember, Chair, that first of all, if the if the minister determine a constitution and it is in line with the current constitution of ACTA, is in line with that one, then there's no amendment and it is deemed to continue to be in terms of that prescribed constitution. If it is possible to deal with a constitution which is not in line with the prescribed constitution, but can be through the deviation clause, the part of the act and within the framework of the regulations, then that is also acceptable. And then lastly, if there is no chance to fit the current constitution of ACTA within the prescribed regulation, then there is a directive that the minister must provide another constitution to that CETA. So, Chair, that is the last issue that we've just corrected on that one. So, Chair, that is the issue. Then we've rejected the schedule as it is there. And then, Chair, as a result of the rejection, there's also a need to amend the long title, and we've dealt with that as well. And just to delete the words, the approval of the constitution, but it is to provide the constitution. So, Chair, that is the amended or the document that we've provided, and Chair, it is, as I said, the interpretation we've given to the mandate from the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Any comments from members? On the presentation?
Thank you, Chairperson. I obviously would like to argue against and in favor of some of the clauses, but that is a political debate, obviously, between us as the members, and that will probably be a slightly longer debate as well. May I just firstly object to the fact that we have just now, this morning, received documentation with quite major changes, but also that the documentation that we've received is full of errors. Even if you just check the numbering of the paragraphs, and I will point that out just now, then also the Parliamentary Legal Services have apparently tried to incorporate the summary of the changes that Advocate Boshoff has just taken us through into this other document. But even that merging was done with mistakes. And let me just show you on the first page. The one that we've received via email this morning speaks of, on page 5, clause 8, on page 5, in line 2, to omit 3002 and to substitute 2002. I believe this is the document that came from Advocate Boshoff. Okay. Parliament, people have said, on page 5, in line 2, to omit 3002 and to substitute 2002, but then where they show us, they say it's 2003, which is the correct one. Now, my first question is, which of these documents must we now believe? Which one will we adopt if we adopt the document today? Advocate Boshoff's document or Parliamentary Legal Services? Perhaps we can just get clarity on that so that otherwise we will be referring to different documents, and I'm afraid the same mistakes that have haunted this process this far will just continue. May I just add, Chair, I've been approached by some CETAs earlier in this year who've been very upset about the constitutions that were presented to them as fait accompli and the short notices with which they've been presented. I now start to understand why they've been upset. Because if we at Parliament is presented with documents that are so fraught with mistakes, then I can just imagine they that work with this every day, how upset they must have been. So can we just first get clarity on which document will we use this afternoon, so that we at least, when I give my comments, that I will at least know which document I must comment on.
I think let's address ourselves to the presentation by Advocate Boshoff.
Okay.
Once we do any other thing, it won't be appropriate.
Okay. Can I then continue on that document? Shall I then continue, sir? Yeah, thank you. Okay, so on page 1, unfortunately the pages are not numbered, but on the first page, that to substitute 3002 with 2002, that is incorrect. It should be the Act of 2003, I believe. Good. Then also, and remember, again, we've been put under severe time constraints. If I go to the next page, sir, it says here on page 1, the Senate Constitution, the thinner one.
The other one.
The thinner one, not the one with the blocks, text box blocks.
This one.
The four-page document. Okay, and I see the other pages are numbered. Okay. See, it says the standard constitution referred to in subsection must at least contain the following. And then on page 2 it says, under E, a strategic plan for the CETA. Now, surely a constitution can't contain a strategic plan for a CETA. It can contain the need for a strategic plan of a CETA or something to that effect. But to say that the Constitution must contain a strategic plan, I think that is just silly. But also, sir, on that same page 2, if you look under paragraph F, the accounting authority of the CETA regarding 1, or I, its members, Roman 2, its powers and duties, and then we jump to 4, its size. What should be the, what happened to paragraph 3? Okay. It may just be a numerical error, but please, sir, I object to us being served with such documentation. Under 10, it says also, that is now F10, also on page 2. It says, such a CETA, the accounting authority of CETA regarding the suspension of members. I would prefer things like the possible suspension of members, or the rules under which members may be suspended, things like that. Then if we go to the next page, sir, page 3, under H, and I'm just mentioning a few that I've picked up in the severely limited time that I've had to look at. H, the chairperson of in the accounting authority. This is now what the officials of the department want us to adopt as legislation. The chairperson of in the accounting authority. It just doesn't make sense. Then under I, meetings, and I would presume, I would propose that we add a comma, special meetings and meeting procedures, and then again, and special meetings. So there's a duplication of special meetings. Which one must we have? Or do you want to make a case that there must be a duplication of meetings, special meetings, meeting procedures, and special meetings in one sentence? It's just silly. Then also, sir, may I add that I've submitted and some other proposals which unfortunately we have not been given any feedback on. And I would love to know then if the department rejects those proposals, why it believes that it should reject those proposals. I have, for example, in the main act asked that the accounting authority, when it speaks to the composition of the accounting authority, that the word governance function of the accounting authority be brought into. It says here, people must know, have the experience required for the effective functioning of the CETA in question. But I want to say to you, the corruption and the problems that we have seen in the CETAs are when the board have become involved in the management of the CETA, where they've interfered with the allocation of contracts, etc. And they've not observed their governance role, which is different from the management role. So we in the main act want people, and we almost encourage them to become involved in the management of the CETAs, whereas I would like to make a case today to say that we must concentrate on the governance role of that. Perhaps I must just first stop so that the department may just respond to you know what I've pointed out this far. Thank you.
Yes. Also, I understand that it's a political debate, as I said. The issue of a rejection or otherwise of the proposals is within the realm of parliamentarians. You will have to convince one another in the process of engagement, as we do now. Can I allow the department to respond on the other issues that they think they are qualified to respond to?
Yeah, Chair, you're absolutely correct by indicating that this is just a document to assist the committee in formulating the own thoughts about what is possible within the structure that's provided. Chair, we've also had very limited time to deal with it, and we apologize for the mistake, but it is not the document that is published in the Gazette. It is merely to assist the committee in looking at it and to get a better understanding of how it would formulate in legislation the discussions that took place during the previous meeting. So, Chair, there's no status to it. It's not that this document must be accepted. And, Chair, it is not the intention also of the department to reject or to provide a position on the comments made by the members. It is, as I've indicated, an interpretation that we've considered as the legal team to identify the discussion and see how we can formulate and try to assist the committee in getting to an understanding of what the discussion has been. Some of the issues raised by the Honourable Member's document, there were no clarification given as to what if it is accepted or not. And Chair, as I've indicated, the approach was to focus solely on the issue of the rejection of the schedule, dealing with the consequences to that, and to provide a correction of the Chair, we obviously still made a mistake in that one. It must be 2003. But there's no status to it. It is for this committee to identify what would be in the so-called ABLE, and we will provide an updated document on this one in order to give effect to what the committee decided, and that would be the basis of the legislation for the final decisions.
Chair, I might just add, the biggest challenge was that even in the first Constitutional Court case of our democracy, Justice Mohammed spoke of subordinate legislation. So that was our biggest problem, to make sure that nothing falls through the cracks. So we worked on it Thursday afternoon, and we sent it off on Thursday afternoon. So obviously we looked at these things over the weekend and we saw these things, but the biggest challenge was to make sure that we create a framework in the legislation within which the minister can make regulations, because you cannot go wider than the framework, otherwise it will be ultra vires and unconstitutional.
I can give you the second part of the chair.
Thank you, Chair. So I take it that my comments will be taken into account when the next version of the changes will be. May I then just say thank you very much. I think it's an improvement in terms of the legislation that the Constitution no longer appears, as we've argued last week. So at least for that one, thank you for that. May I just then ask that when the Constitution is dealt with as regulations, that you look seriously at the version that we had in front of us.
The contributions that members made, in fact, to shape the approach that we should have in this sector.
Yeah. Thank you. May I then proceed, sir? In terms of the, on page 8 of the legislation, line 5, in the main act it has got the wordings of the chief executive officer must stay in office for a period of 6 months if the CETA in question has been re-established. Now, as I've said, my limited legal knowledge tells me it's very difficult to put in an act that somebody must stay in office. You know, the member may die and then commit a crime. But I think in the Constitution, which we've now scrapped, I think the wording there was a far better wording when that, I think it has got something to do with the contract may be extended for a period of 6 months, if you want. On page 27, you will see the page 27, line 17, it says the chief executive officer may be retained for a further 6 months in the event that the CETA is re-established in accordance. And I would...
Let's say that to me.
That's right. So that's my suggestion, that the wording in the Constitution now be moved to the main act, may be retained for a further 6 months.
I'm saying the best one, we can just say may, so that we must not be having more writing. It's still really sustainable.
Thank you for that, Chair. Then also, Chair, and sorry if I now jump around a bit, at the bottom of page 6, and I would really like to get some legal advice on this. There, paragraph B3 says, if any accounting authority member fails to disclose any interest as required by subsection 2 or subject to the provisions of that subsection, etc., etc., the proceedings of the accounting authority, the relevant proceedings of the accounting authority shall be null and void. Now, in the first point, I'm just wondering if declaring that null and void, the fact that he has not declared his interests may not have influenced the good decision that was taken. And the problem is people may be affected by that decision. Say, for example, somebody has been awarded a contract for photocopying or whatever. So on the one hand, I've got a problem to say it will be null and void, because that has got serious consequences, not for the member who failed to declare, but for the accounting authority and the people affected by that contract. But then secondly, there's no consequence, it seems, for the member who failed to declare. And I think the point of that sort of thing is we want to discipline members to declare. Do I make myself clear, gentlemen? It should not be the CETA that suffers because of this member's failure to declare his or her interests. It should be that member that should suffer. The member should then be removed, even perhaps, but that is for the legal experts to advise us in that regard. Then, also, Chair, if I may just go to page 8. Line 14, it deals here with the minister's role. The minister may, after consultation with the National Skills Authority, make regulations regarding, and then we jump to B, the salary level of the chief executive officer. I was actually contemplating, suggesting that we say the salary level and service conditions, so that the minister is not only limited to say, this is your salary, but that the minister may also impose service conditions such as the term of office or the fringe benefits or leave benefits, should the minister so wish. I mean, but then we open up that opportunity for the minister. Thank you. And then, Chair, I also believe that there's still a Section 5 appearing in the Act, even after these amendments. Let me just quickly go to what the... on page 10, in line 13, I'm not sure if I saw in what the advocate has presented to us that section 5 in line 13 has also been scrapped. And I would then propose that reference there is also good. Then, okay. And then just lastly, Chip, and this is my ignorance in terms of the legislation, on page 9, line 23, and it later on appears in line 31 and 35 as well, do you believe that we should still be referring there to the South African Qualifications Authority Act, or should that be the NQF Act? I wasn't able to go and check whether the establishment of ETQAs is dealt with in the NQF Act. So please, if you could get us some comments on that.
Honorable Dukoba, then we'll come later.
Thanks, and our thanks to the department. I just want to clear my head on the issue of let me start with the issue of the may not include more than, and as compared to the previous one, because so in other words, the view of the department is that you only seek approval for deviation if you're going up and not going down, because my understanding is that if we are set, no, the number is 6, but people may apply for deviation. It means if I want 3, I must apply for deviation, because the number is 6. If I want 10, I must apply for deviation. But then the department says, no, let's say no more than 6. In other words, the understanding is that deviation is only when you go up, if you want to exceed 6. So because I had thought that it was 6 in such a way that if you want to depart from 6, apply for deviation and show good cause. The other one relates to the one of approve and provide. It may be that I'm lost a little bit, because if you have what we have, and we say, I agree, we said it mustn't be in the Act, but it's going to be elsewhere. This draft constitution or a framework or whatever. Now, my understanding is that the minister has provided the framework. A CETA, the accounting authority, will then go and draw their own constitution in line with that framework that has been provided. And once completed, you then take it to the minister, who will then approve after satisfying himself, herself, that you have done it in line with the framework. That was my understanding of approve. Now, I don't think the minister is going to provide constitution. The minister provides a framework, CETAs draw the constitution, the minister approves. Unless there is something that I'm missing. But if we are going to say the minister must provide the constitution, so it means the department, for every CETA, they must sit down, write the constitution, and go and deliver it. But there is an even more dangerous part. Why do we need boards if the department can draw the constitutions? What is the duty of having a board now? Because the board is the accounting authority, and that also includes drawing a constitution, but we understand the right to draw a constitution is not unfettered, hence the need for approval. Have I missed something?
Clarified, Honorable Dukoba. We said that the minister will determine a standard constitution. Now, this standard constitution may not suit the general needs of every CETA. Now, in the event that a particular CETA is concerned with its structural arrangements, it will then say, would like it to look this way here and there. The minister will then make sure that is taken care of. I know the debate is not at that level.
It's at the level of the process of acknowledging the contributions of the sitters in the finalization of their constitutions. I'm sure that is a role that we could play at a later stage where a sitter is concerned that their views are not being taken care of. However, I think the perspective that the minister must provide a constitution, it would not be, say 21 constitutions. It will be a single constitution. And then every sitter would then see whatever area that it feels unhappy about and then approach the minister. We would like our structure to be different here and there, looking at the one is and so on. If I may, Chair, that's why I say maybe I'm lost a bit, because for me, that which the minister provides is a framework, skeleton constitution, if you like. It's a framework. Based on that, you go and then draw your own constitution. We can't call that a constitution. That which the minister provides, because among others, it says, tell us what your name is. Tell us this and that. So it's almost like a guideline, constitutional guideline. I don't know, a framework. I don't know if we want to call that a constitution. Because if we do, a sitter may just receive it and start working on it without doing anything. I don't know, but let me hear what other colleagues are saying. I'll come back.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, first of all, the issues clause 11 and the aspect of clause 10, which is dealing with the new section 11b sub 3, which is providing for the words null and void. So you get two positions in law. The one is where there is no compliance with the structural framework, and the court of law can declare that actions voidable. And then you can also have a situation where the legislation, as a consequence of law, regard that transgression so serious that it have a consequence which is null and void. So it says that due to the fact that this critical element has not been complied with, the actions are therefore not, no matter what good intentions, no matter what mitigating factors, it is so serious that one must consider this as starting from the scratch again and deal with it in the correct manner. And not going to court each time and not wasting public resources in doing so, but if there is no declaration, so every member of a sitter must be sensitized. If you don't declare, there's serious consequences of law. And that is what is the wording provided for. There's different approaches, but the proposal that the minister put on the table is to say that the issue here is that if you don't do your job and provide in that performing of your function the necessary declaration, it is such a serious aspect that it cannot be condoned. And therefore, the consequence is in the action, and it is not to deal with it as the position put by the Honourable Member is to say, put a sanction to the member who actually caused it. Now, Chair, we saw it in the legislation with the colleges and with the higher education, where sanctions have been introduced. It is possible to deal with it that way around. It is not part of the current structure. Chair, those were issues that came about during the deliberations at that point in time, and it was not part of the drafting of this bill at that stage when we put it to Parliament or introduce it in Parliament. So, Chair, it is for the committee to decide if there should be a sanction or not. Chair, the aspect of the Constitution in Clause 13, if I can move to that one, which is to provide or to approve. Chair, it is a very interesting aspect because the minister appoints the members. The minister prescribes a constitution. The minister also can deviate from it. And therefore the question would be, what would be the approval? And if the CETA is not following the prescribed processes, the prescribed framework, what would be the situation? Must it mean that you must go to court each time and compel them to provide one within the framework of the law? Or are we going to get a situation that there's interpretation to say that, Minister, you can actually deviate from the prescribed framework and that's why you must approve it? I'm not sure what is the effect of approval in the framework that's now on the table. Because it is said, Minister, you must determine a structure. So every CETA will know what would be the standard constitution. And that would give that CETA an obligation to identify within the prescripts of the law, because it is important that it is not an unfettered discretion to deviate. But to come to the minister and say, Minister, this one size can't fit my specific CETA, consider something else. And then the minister provide a CETA within the framework. So, Chair, it is a matter of, it's a consequence of law which provide the framework. It is the minister who then deal with it within that framework and provide the flexibility. The framework provides the flexibility to deviate or not. And the outcome of that is then a issuing of a constitution. And therefore, it was the view of the three legal teams to say, but what would be the implication of a proof? What would be the meaning of a proof? Approve your own actions? Approve that what is there, because it cannot deviate from it unless there is a decision to deal with that. And therefore, what would be the effect of it? And that is why the word's been changed to say that the minister provide instead of approve. If there was any decisions or leeway for the CETAs to develop anything outside that framework, then approval might have been a position, but there is nothing in our view within the current framework, because it is a prescription by law, it is regulations, they are law, and over and above the regulations, it is the framework that's provided in this Act, which is dealing with the composition, the process of it, the CEO, and the tenure of the CEO, and all those things. So the next issue that I just need to comment on, and that is the issue of it is in clause 13B, which is dealing with the issues pertaining to may stay in office or must stay in office. May is an acceptable amendment, and one can easily affect that. If there's no problem with that, and it is making much more sense. When it comes to sub 4B, which is dealing with the regulations that the minister must develop pertaining to the salary, in C, it says the criteria and process to enable the accounting officer to offer the accounting authority to determine other conditions of service. Chair, the Minister cannot by regulations determine conditions of service. It's the issues that must be through collective bargaining determined. What the Minister can deal with is the basic framework within which the upper limits, for instance, a link to another structure. But the actual bargaining, especially when it comes to conditions of service, is determined by the Labour Relations Act, and one must acknowledge that. And what the Minister can deal with in the, what is in C is providing a identification of a responsibility to at least determine the processes or allude to the processes and also the procedures which will allow for the development of that conditions of service and which is determined by the accounting authority to the staff. So, Chair, I think it is fairly much in line with the views of the member. Chair, the other issue that's been referred to is in clause 26. Clause 26, which deals with A in particular, is dealing with the it is a existing Schedule 2A, which is referring to ETQAs as a transitional arrangement. ETQAs does not exist in terms of the current NQF Act. It's not part of it. But as a transitional arrangement in that Act, it was kept alive up until the QCTO is fully functional. The CETAs will continue to act as an ETQA in terms of their appointment or the establishment of the old SAQWA Act. But the definition of SAQWA Act have been taken out, and therefore the reference in the schedule must therefore get the reference of that Act in this schedule in order to make it meaningful as a transitional arrangement to that. And that is why that reference is still in place. Just the last issue of the reference to Schedule 5 in Clause 30. I think we did address it in the document, but we will just make absolutely sure that we've covered both the reference to Schedule 5 as it is in it. But it's clear, the principle is clear, that there must not be a reference to Schedule 5 at all in this. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Mponya.
Thank you, Chair. It's an unusual procedure, you know, for the last 10 years or so. I've never seen our bills being hastily rushed like this one. I don't know why. There's unusual haste. Having said that, let me refer to that clause on sanctions. Just to get from the department their further clarification. One member errs, he doesn't disclose, and the whole proceedings are declared null and void. It's like wanting to kill a snake in your house, then you burn the whole house because there's a snake. It's not really wise. Why don't we just go to that individual who has failed to disclose other than declaring the whole proceedings null and void? It's like in a department, if one person errs, you suspend that one individual and you let the whole proceedings go on. I'm not alluding to anything here. And also on the question of the concession, like our colleague Kobo, I'm not really very clear on this one. Perhaps it's in the afternoon. One is this time of the day was low in uptake, you know.
They are basically giving the minister power there so that the sitters must not be above the minister, because we have got an idea of looking at the sitter as outside the state. Now, this is a creature of the state. Basically, we are giving the minister the power to determine a constitution for an entity that accounts to him. You see, that's how it must be.
That's exactly what I'm arguing, Chair. You know, these sitters, we have put these sitters to perform specific functions, and believing in their competence and all other essential qualities to perform their duties. Now, I just want to be clear. Here is the framework which the minister provides. The sitters don't have to do any other thing. They just have to implement the framework.
They can apply for deviation. The issue is about power. I think we must debate it at the later stage, maybe. The government is very interested in this debate. It's about who should determine a constitution for a sitter. That is basic. Is it the minister, or this entity must control itself? For instance, determine its way to go. Or is it the minister who must have a constitution and say, you are my entity, here is how you're going to operate. Let's debate it.
So, follow up. The problem is in the wording, perhaps. The minister approves. We have removed approve. The minister provides the constitution, and the sitters just implement, or they will apply for. Yes. Now, after, say, they apply for a deviation, they are given the power to draft a sort of a constitution. What happens to that one? Doesn't the minister approve what is still provided? You know, this power reminds me of the late Trini. He said, never share power. So the minister here would never share power with the sitters.
No, Chappas, I think we are missing the point here. We are missing the point. Because we can be very harsh in our approach and say that we don't want sitters to run themselves. But a sitter is not a department. That is why in the department you have a DG and a minister. There's nothing in between. You don't have a board for Department of Higher Education. But the sitter is something different. It's not even a public entity. What's that? It's a public entity, not an enterprise. But also these public entities are classified according to schedules. And this schedule will actually tell you the distance between that entity and the political head, if you like. Now, let me use this document that we have. The thing that we said, and we have never said as a committee, there mustn't be, what is it called, a standard constitution. We have never said that. But we said, no, don't put it in the bill. But listen to what the standard constitution says. The I'm using this document at the page one at the end. The responsibility of the accounting authority of the sitter, the identification of the sitter by name. In other words, go and draw your own constitution. Tell us what your name is. You go on, set out your scope of coverage. And then the list is endless. Tell us about your size. Tell us about your members. Tell us about your capacity. Tell us how you're going to nomination and appointment of members. It's almost like a template. It's almost like a template. Now feel what is applicable to you. So we can't say the template is the constitution.
It is definitely not. Go and draw your own concerns to accounting authority in line with this template, according to the template. When you have done so, bring it to me as minister for approval. And in the process of approving, I must make sure that whatever product you have is in line with the template. So for that reason, I'm saying I don't understand when you say the minister must provide a constituent. The minister provides a template. That's where I'm arguing from. I don't argue the power of the minister over the sitters, because if I did, I would not even mention approval. I would argue that the boards are autonomous, blah, 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 blah. That's not our argument. We just want to clarify this process of approve and provide. Because if he has provided the template, we can't call the template a constitution.
Thank you, Chair. One must just remember the act prescribed to the minister. This is the framework for the minister. Then the minister prescribed by regulation. In these regulations will be the standard constitution. So everybody will see the standard constitution. Identification by name, the minister will, in the regulation, say the name of the sitter is, and then leave it open so that whichever sitter's name will then be in there. But this Parliament cannot abrogate its lawmaking power. It must tell the minister, you must prescribe a constitution, a standard constitution, but it must be within these parameters. It can't go outside this. This is what we want in Parliament. Says this is what must be in the constitution. But this is in line with what the courts interpret the drafting of subordinate legislation in terms of under the constitution.
Before we go on, because I think then we are in agreement. Let's go to this document that we have, the SICA one. Clause 6. Section 9A of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitute, and we say 2. The minister must, we cancel approve. We say provide a constitution contemplated in Section 5. But now, I didn't hear his name, but he's now saying a standard constitution. Maybe we must write that. Because that's where the problem is. The minister must provide a standard. Except that standard is not written in the document that you're supposed to approve. Yeah.
It says in clause 6, it says the minister approves a constitution contemplated in section 13. If you go to section 13.1, it says the minister approves or provides a constitution for everything which subject to this act must be in line with the standard constitution prescribed by regulation by the minister. So the cross reference brings it back to the standard constitution.
Yeah, on the non-disclosure, thank you, Chair. And what is contemplated to be the action there? So that action is not exclusive to the consequences that an individual could possibly face, but is drawn out of the understanding that such a process, which may have come out of non-disclosure, in the majority of cases is always in collusion with something else. And therefore then, to afford the fairness, substantively so, it becomes quite important that when a decision is taken, there shouldn't be interference by certain interests that were not disclosed in the process.
because the consequences are actually too dire. And I think this perhaps taken into consideration with what the system at the present moment is actually experiencing, how this practice is obtaining in the actual implementation, I think it's actually producing good results, you know, for the system, you know, thus far. Because we're talking about something which is already in experimentation. And what impact the system has made thus far in this interim arrangement is really too huge to really not to acknowledge that. So the non-disclosure one is not necessarily that an individual won't be facing some consequences, but that kind of practice, it's normally done in collusion with.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, to answer the member's question, the Constitutional Court has taken a position that in instances where there is collusion in any organ of state, it is the duty of that organ of state or that that public entity to approach the courts to have that decision set aside. This section officially then preempts that by saying it's going to be null and void regardless. So, in instance, because otherwise it leads to lots of litigation, and then that that entity or department or any organ of state will then be taken to court, and there'll be a long legal battle. This section, which is then included, preempts that.
Thank you, Chair. What I'd like to just bring members' attention to is under 11B subsection 2, and it talks about at any stage during the course of any proceedings. So it doesn't talk about a conflict of interest prior to a meeting being convened. It's during that particular proceedings. Now, what may happen is that the proceedings may continue with the conflict being known, number one, or the person that is conflicted refusing to leave the meeting. And therefore, this is a protection to say stop all proceedings, close the meeting, and restart the process, because then the legislature comes in again that a person cannot enter the meeting because they've got a conflict. So, I mean, I think that subtlety must be taken note of.
Once again, I think the approach is that it doesn't go far enough. I have not heard a member say no, it's a terrible thing. Just to say, but I've also heard Advocate Boshoff saying, well, we didn't provide for it, the committee can edit. Well, that's the part that I heard. But what I just wanted to establish, and I hear what Mr. Patel is saying, we're talking about, it's an hypothetical situation. In other words, something has happened, there was conflict of interest, and there was prejudice. Let's say I'm a complainant, and I say that, you know, Honorable Global Lawrence said a conflict of interest. Where is the element of prejudice? Shouldn't I also prove that I was prejudiced by that, or the fact that there was conflict of interest, whether it led to any prejudice or not? I'm not very sure.
We are certain that the aspect of conflict of interest arises when it relates to a favor accruing to a particular person. So the fact that Dr. Lawrence Lopez had a company which had bid for this tender, and she sees that meeting and deliberates on the matter, does not recuse herself, and a contract gets awarded to that company, then that decision, to that extent, is null and void. We should reconsider this decision. The moment we know this, the company was suspended, the contract is cancelled, and so on. But I think the point we are raising, we passed the other two legislation. I don't know whether why those elements? Why couldn't we just have the same, you know, section? Because I think in one of those deliberations we're very firm, and Cedric Prusal, all those elements, can't we ask them just to have that one, the same one? Yes.
In the Education and ACD Colleges Act, there's been inclusion of a code of conduct and also procedures to be developed for the members, and the sanction is that the individual member can be suspended from meetings or even be disbarred as a member or terminating the membership. So it is possible to just bring it that same.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, if the members can then turn to page number 7 of the of this document, which is the amendment bill. It says there under 13A, subsection 3B, a member referred to under paragraph A is obliged to recuse himself. So I think that sets the procedure in instances where there is a conflict of interest. It deals under the heading the conduct of the accounting authority member or staff member. Then also, if members can then turn to the annexure, which is now, to the schedule, which is now the annexure, it deals with the suspension of members of the accounting authority. That's on page number 20. And then it sets out the grounds on which members may be suspended. Well, that will obviously then go into the constitution. So I think it is covered for in terms of where there is a conflict of interest, both in the annexure and in the main act.
I just on the members of the accounting authority on page 6 as well, the eligibility to become a member, I presume, of accounting authority. I find it strange, for example, that there are 5 things mentioned, meaning that you must be a South African citizen and you may not have been convicted in court of certain things, but then it does not say that you may not be employed by any CETA. So what happens is, what could happen is, you may be an employer of a CETA and you may still be in terms of 11A eligible to become a member of an accounting authority. And I would also go further to say that you may not be a staff member of any CETA and then serve on the accounting authority of another CETA. So I would also propose the addition of a paragraph F there. Then?
CEO of a particular CETA, and people want me to serve in a board of another CETA. Would that be unfair? I'm an expert in my own right, and a sought-after skill, you know? Yes.
You see, Chairperson, the amendments that you have had, both in the Higher Education and FET Act, and the one that you are discussing now, are an indication of our desire to root out corruption. So everything that we see, we're trying to strengthen the independence, but also the arm to deal with issues of. And maybe I'm just asking myself, you remember we listened to people from higher education, because we were saying, no, if you are employed by this institution, you can't do business with it. And remember, we have passed that, except that we had come up with, special conditions under which, you are a sole provider of this thing, it's a unique whatever. The question is, can't we bring that provision, that as soon as you are a board member, you can't do business with that seat? Here we say, we just mentioning conflict of interest as something that can be vague, and at times debatable, but there we were very firm. I want that in, because it is the same committee that was fighting corruption in those bills, and the same stamina is still here today. That's why I'm saying maybe we must also bring those clauses here, because our aim is still the same.
new topic?
Yeah, let's proceed. I'm sure we're adopting the bill. I can see that we're already adopting the bill.
No.
Whatever issues that we have.
Chairperson, may I also refer you to the last page, page 10. There it says, notwithstanding subsection 1, the minister may not determine a date on which sections so and so take effect. Now, some of those sections have just been repealed by this bill. Section 24, section 25, for example, which are mentioned there, are repealed. Now, should we not take out the reference to that in that paragraph, or should we then say, may not determine a date on which these sections will be repealed, you know, unless the Minister of Labour has approved such determinants? But it just seems to me a bit problematic for us to refer to something which we've already decided that it will be repealed, therefore it will be scrapped, and then we say it will be it will take effect on a specific date. So perhaps the legal team could just advise us on that one, please.
It's a very important provision, this, because it must be coordinated with other legislation that's currently going on in the Parliament or in Parliament in the portfolio dealing with Labour. Chair, it is important that the wording is drafted in a sense to say that these are issues that the President identified as sections which should not be part, or it's not under the authority of the Minister of Higher Education and Training, but assign those functions to the Minister of Labour. So, Chair, you must clean up the legislation. It must be cleaned up. But when do you clean it up is very important. So Parliament provided these must be repealed, but also say that the actual date by which it becomes effective, when that repeal becomes the date which is the consequence of this decision, will be the date determined by the minister. And that date will mean the date when the repeal actually comes into it. Up until now, it's just a notice that this is law that will be coming into effect at a later stage. But the Act is still running with those clauses in it up until the date of that notice. So, Chair, there is no, it's a consequence that's following, and it will only be on the condition that that legislation or that notice is then published by the minister. And it can only be dealt with if the Minister of Labour agree to that in order to ensure that that coordination is there. If the Minister of Labour do not agree with it, it would be outside the framework of law, and therefore it can be challenged and will still keep that provision alive up until the correct approach have been taken by the minister to get the approval of the Minister of Labour before that notice can be published.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced that what we have in front of us is correct. Perhaps Advocate Boshoff could just then explain to us, if we say the minister may not determine a date on which section, let's say then 24, take effect. What do you mean by section 24 take effect?
Chair, in terms of the Constitution, section 81, it reads as follows: a bill assented to and signed by the President becomes an Act of Parliament, must be published promptly, and then, important, takes effect when published or on a date determined in terms of the Act. Now, in terms of section clause 3.1, this Act comes into operation on a date determined by the Minister by notice in the Gazette. So, and the different dates may be determined on the subsection 1 in respect of different provisions of the Act. But in terms of those sections listed in schedules in subsection 3, those sections will only take effect in terms of the Constitution when the Minister has the approval of the Minister of Labour, because the Minister of Labour is currently amending acts or publishing or drafting or legislation to deal with these specific provisions. So the moment when they are, those provisions are ready, then section 25 will take effect in it will be repealed.
Sorry, Chair, I don't think we're on the same song sheet here. Can I just say, on page 10, it says, notwithstanding subsection 1, the Minister may not determine the date on which sections, and then it mentions a number of sections. Are you referring there to the sections in the Principal Act?
Yes.
Must we not say that?
The clause is clause 23, and it says section 26N of the Principal Act is hereby repealed. That's what the clause says. But the effect of that in the Principal Act is only when the minister determines that notice in the Gazette, and then the that section which is dealing, if we use the clause 23 as example, 26N is dealing with regulations regarding workplace productivity and competitiveness. So that section will remain on the statute books as effective law up until the date when that notice is effectively published with the concurrence of the Minister of Labour.
Bojan, you wanted to say something earlier on, if I may. Anything that you want to say?
Chairperson, mine was on the issue of the strategic plan. But isn't it so that the department submits the strategic plan annually? So how would that then, it says a strategic plan, but that plan comes in annually anyway. The CETA's stress plan.
The Public Finance Management Act probably also requires an amendment because a strat plan must be for 5 years and should actually be submitted once, but on a yearly basis there must be an annual plan. That's where I think we should address the relevant particular committee to deal with in the future, and I'm sure that is what we need to do. But I agree with you. Are you saying that it has got an implication for the bill somewhere?
No, Chairperson, I just wanted clarity around that, because, I mean, your targets every year are different. So you have your one stress plan, but you have your targets annually. So is this encompassed in this?
Yeah, CETA is actually operating within a framework which is set by the Act and also by the National Skills Strategy. And then that is within a lifespan of normally 5 years, but the Act is a time determined by the Minister. And up to now it's worked in cycles of 5 years. The need for such a plan, or the Constitution to refer to it and to identify that role of that CETA in delivering that space provided by the National Skills Strategy to deliver on their responsibilities is what we refer to in this Constitution. And that is what the Minister will clarify when it comes to dealing with it in the Constitution. But it must be addressed, because it's a very important focus for that CETA to deliver on this Act and on the National Skills Strategy.
Do you want to say something?
May I just get clarity? Will we now accept that you may be employed by the CETA and also serve on the accounting authority, even by your own CETA? You may even serve on the board of the CETA of which you are a staff member.
Is there a mischief in that? That's what we must look at as members of parliament. Is there a mischief in that? If there is, then we'll have a problem with it. But for me, from my perspective, if you value my skills and want me to be deployed anywhere else, I must be. So it is open, but usually it may not be the practice. I mean, as parliament, let's not go to extremes. I think let's allow that space to prevail. Because
for me, it's almost like an automatic conflict of interest. An automatic conflict of interest. You are a staff member, therefore accountable to the CEO, who is accountable to the board. So effectively, you are accountable to yourself. And therefore, the CEO is accountable to you. Your own boss. No, I'm saying it can't be allowed. It shouldn't be allowed. It's a recipe for disaster.
No, Chair, I was just saying you can't throw a javelin and want to catch it in the other fight. It's very highly important.
I agree with you.
It's just like you, Chair, being a member of parliament, then you want to be a DG. Of higher education and training. You want to come and... No, can't.
Would have appointed me. Okay, that's fine. What do you suggest? Do you want us to include something there? A clause there? To say yes.
Chair, I would then like to propose that we add an additional paragraph if under 11A, because you know what can happen is, for example, you serve on the board of a CETA, they advertise a post, you apply for that post, you know, be the CEO post or whatever, and I want you to then resign as a board member if you become a staff member of that CETA, for example. So something to the effect that a person does not qualify for appointment to an and the word appointment we must perhaps reconsider, to an accounting authority, if such member is employed by the CETA in question. I'm not the legal person with the right wording.
No, I think it's making sense. Yeah, we just have to work out a formulation which is going to capture that point, you know, which is... It's making an absolute sense.
May I just check, the word appointment in 11A is perhaps just then a difficult one, because this person may already have been appointed and then the situation may change. So perhaps the word appointment must be then, may not serve on or something to that effect. Because once you know, at the time when you're appointed, you were not a staff member, okay? So the legal people will just have to please, but I think they've got the idea that we want to achieve.
I'm sure Albert Boshan is following. He understands how to approach it.
I know we are not addressing this part, some of those people who were in the CETA for some time, they actually will tell you since then. I'm not sure if Firoz, Mr. Patel remembers, where you have a chairperson of the board, a post of CEO is advertised, and the chairperson applies. It has happened several times and caused big problems. So I don't know how it can... Because basically, you actually have board members creating positions for themselves.
As long as he would recuse himself and we don't appoint that
person. The problem is that there is no level playing field. There should not be a fight coming from the chairperson. There is no way the other person can be.
Clause 10, which is the new section 11, capital A, is dealing with the eligibility. And that is when you're dealing with the appointment of the members. And one can include that as suggested, and we will look at the language. The other issue, if you're already a member and you are then appointed, then it becomes what they call vacation of office, which is currently provided for as one of the aspects where the minister in the regulations must provide the framework within which a member must vacate office, and that must then repeat it. If the members want vacation of office to be taken out and put some language to it, as we've got a language already in the schedule, we can bring it in as a further section to the Act to deal with not only the eligibility of a member but also the vocation as members from it as a section. That's another option for the committee to consider. But to confuse the two, to deal with the eligibility when you deal with the appointment of members, and to infuse that also with the vacation of office because of certain conditions, might become a bit problematic if we confuse those two elements. Chair, we can leave it as it is, and it will be addressed in the regulations. Or if the committee feel they don't want to leave it to the regulations, then we can take that part which is currently in the regulations and add to it also that it is a person who is a member of that CITA or accounting authority and get appointment must vacate his position as a member with immediate effect. One can just add that to it. No, it would be a new subsection which under heading of vocation of membership of the accounting authority.
So what would he need to clarify in relation to that is at what point one has to vacate the office in relation to this specific point. It would be quite important to get an indication as to how should it be determined.
Yeah, on application maybe. If you apply, it means you no longer want to be the head of the board.
You don't get a post. You're not a member. You're not an employee either.
No, I don't agree with that, Chairperson.
I hear what you are saying. Maybe they'll know how to formulate it. But the danger of it is that we're not going to sit again and deal with that. If we've got a definite view, let's be directive so that then as they work on it, they know our clear position. I don't know.
Chief, my preferred position would be that we deal with it under under two headings. Unfortunately, at this point in time, it seems to me as if neither the Principal Act nor the Amendment Bill deals with the vacation of office.
In the schedule, we can use the language that you use in the schedule.
That's right. And it seems to me that is a part of the schedule that we might perhaps consider bringing into the main bill. Because it has to do with the situation where somebody is firstly appointed as a member, then that person may not be a staff member, but then also should that person become a staff member through the course of the 5-year term, then that member must also vacate the office. So I would suggest that we bring in that whole paragraph dealing with the vacation of office.
So it is on page 20 of the current book. Bottom part, it's under that subsection 13. We can bring that into the bill with the added provision that if there is an appointment, then that person also vacates.
Minister, did I hear you correctly said you are not going to meet again after these amendments? We're going to adopt clause by clause. On Wednesday, and debate the following day, Thursday. We're debating the same day. So look, in the morning, you adopt the bill and even debate it in the afternoon. So whatever formulations you make are very crucial now, because you can't add flesh that time when you're going to be adopting clause by clause. So if I was an employee of the department and I want to sneak something through, that's the moment when you are given this chance, you know, then it is law. You see that opportunity. You see that opportunity, Dr. Bojan?
Well, that's why I said earlier on, it's a little bit rushed. We adopt clause by clause. Same day, I draw up my speech, I go in debate.
Let me explain, Dr. Bojan. This one I must explain. The Skills Act was removed to NEDLAC, where there were substantive and exhaustive discussions between the department and key stakeholders in the sector, because that's the area where you need negotiations. And after that process, the bill had to go to the state law advisors for certification in terms of constitutionality and so on. And now, unfortunately, it had to come when we are closing. It was not necessarily rushed as such. It was an elaborate process. And I know that we are going to debate very sharply, because you are top now, you will debate immediately thereafter. You will still be very hot. It's going to be very exciting.
I understand that one. But it's a bit problematic, because you know what happens after adopting or agreeing to the amendments. I take those back to my caucus for a fresh mandate. I won't be able to do that on Wednesday. And that's where the problem is. But anyway, I've always argued that under democracy, you also suffer the dictatorship of the majority. That's democracy. What can I do?
No, I think there was a way of compensating for it, that whatever formulations we make are making a different impact now. Because when they reformulate, they're going to include that. So already, you are articulating the mandate to them. So when you report back, you'll be saying, I've effected changes of this nature and so on. It don't be like you need a fresh one. You'll just be saying, we've moved very far.
Can I go on to a new point? The subsection 23 of the Mine Act, In this one, it's on page 8, under 15, section 23 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. Now, 23 of the Principal Act still speaks of employment services. And then all the employment services tasks are scrapped, are repealed. So, and I'm going to read to you what remains according to what we have here. 23, employment services. The functions of provincial officers of the department in respect of employment services are to establish a skills development forum as described, to maintain a database of skills development providers within their jurisdiction, and. Okay. Now, it just seems to me, you know, all the employment services, because remember, this act comes from the Department of Labor, and under the original act, what we're now scrapping is to plan, coordinate, support, monitor, and report on all activities occurring at all labor centers, etc. So it just seems to me as if that paragraph 23 in the original act should no longer have the heading of employment services, but should rather be changed to skills development forums or something like that. And I would like to get the input of the legal experts on that.
Chair, that is a specific section which the president assigned
to the Minister of Labour. It is not under the control of the Minister. And so if there is a need to provide new structures of that nature, it might be better to deal with it in further legislation where the consequences, the effect of it, and also the need and the financial implications have been followed through the policy-making process in order to deal with it. Chair, some of this issue when it comes to the departmental structure, it's actually a very interesting approach to see that that is currently provided for in the Skills Development Act when it comes to the provincial offices, when it comes to the specific functions of the Department of Labour. Normally it is dealt with in terms of the Public Service Public Service Act, of 2004, which is providing an organizational structure, and the organizational structure will also include your provincial offices. Chair, it is not dealt with in terms of the main legislation. And so there is obviously, when it comes to the employment of personnel, there's major financial implications to that. And it must be dealt with within the broader discussion of the funding, the budgets of the department, and the needs of the department within the Public Service Act.
I'm sorry, I couldn't really follow that or the logic of that explanation. Section 23 of the Principal Act deals with employment services by the Department of Labour and the setting up of centres, employment services centres. Okay? The functions of the labour centres, and then it continues about to register work seekers, placement opportunities, to assist workers, develop plans, to register unemployed, and so on. All that is scrapped by this bill today, except that we keep the heading employment services. And the contents deals, there's no reference to employment services in the contents. All that it now says is establish a skills development forum as prescribed and to maintain a database of skills development providers. So all I'm asking is that we change the heading so that there is some form of logic. Otherwise, you will have an act saying employment services, and there will be no function regarding employment services.
Mr. Butler?
Yeah, Chair, the member's correct. We'll look at the technical issues. It may mean that we'll just come up with a new clause which would be in C, and then the old one still will remain with the Minister of Labour. But we'll just have to look at it mathematics, a bit complex. But the point is taken that labour will no longer be relevant when the Minister of Labour agrees for the repealing of Section 23. In other words, we'll have two clauses without a heading left in the bill.
Proceed. Yes. No, sir. And then...
Chairperson, I'm back onto the appointment. What are we saying? Are we saying resign on application or resign on appointment? I'm saying that it must be resignation on appointment and not an application. Go to the Electoral Act.
No, we
will be setting a precedent set there already.
We've decided accordingly during that good debate. Yeah. Anyone moving for adoption?
Okay. May I just ask that we get something in front of us that we can adopt? Because what we have at present are some things that we've agreed on, some things which the officials have undertaken to go and amend and serve us with what they deem to be wording that is applicable and that will reflect the opinion of the portfolio committee. And I just cannot agree to adopt to something which I don't have in front of me at all.
No, I know that
the Honourable Van der Westhuizen understands me. We've been debating. We've made contributions. We've come to particular conclusions. It is clear that those are going to be worked on. And on Wednesday morning, we're going to receive a complete written document that articulates what we said. And I can say that with the experience we have had with our officials when we're dealing with the two bills, they've been very, very expeditious, meticulous. We have admonished them this morning for typographical and grammatical mistakes here and there, and they've welcomed that. And I'm certain that on Wednesday we'll get the product we expect. Yes.
Get the relevant documentation a day before. Can't sit for the first time at that meeting.
Yeah, of course. I think maybe let's set a context. I always agree with Dr. Lawrence Globus. The issue is that it is ourselves that caused the situation because we said I must request the minister to exclude particular elements of the bill, and that really caused the legal advisers not to sleep for several days, meeting and redrafting, so that they can achieve our proposal. I'm sure the intricacies of all this is because we had to postpone that the meeting we had and defer the processes. Yes, Tiko.
We are not disputing that, Chairperson, but I don't think we must, as it were, agree that we'll get it in the morning. That wouldn't be a good agreement. We desire that we get it. That notwithstanding, let's get it a day before. And I guess you can already see that is a compromise. Otherwise, we'd have said 48 hours. But we're doing that because we understand the pressure under which people have worked.
To respond, yes.
Thank you, Chair. On Wednesday, unfortunately, I won't be here myself. There's an apology already. But on Wednesday, I will be receiving a bill which has been amended to vote clause by clause. That's my under. Oh, good, good.
But will the Parliamentary Legal Services just advise us before a bill is debated in Parliament, how many hours before that must the bill be published and circulated amongst the members of Parliament?
Thank you, Member. To you, Chair, there's no specific time frame. It's just for the committee members has to give due regard for that bill before the committee at the time. So it's not prescribed in the rules exactly how much time there is. And regardless, the members may suspend those specific rules for the purposes of getting the bill through on time or within a specific time frame, as that committee might deem fit at that specific moment.
Good way. That's also how the judges work, you know. There's a process where they don't allow rules to control them. It's a good strategy. Normally, there's a resolution to that effect that there's a rule that a bill must, but the chief whip normally and always passes the resolution to that effect.
I don't know, maybe legal service must say to us, we'll go and check. We can't say there is no rule, but it can be waived. Why do we waive?
It's a good legal intervention.
Is it a rule?
We're already being advised in advance. I'm sure the officials are trying to work on the things and produce that a little earlier.
What is a little earlier?
You said a day before. They may not sleep. They'll have to be working. Tonight to make sure that we receive the
document. Can you also just make a request? We know that these are difficult times we are working under now.
you know, at times it happens somebody works and emails you something at 17 hours. And then the following day when you say, but I only saw this morning, well, it was, you know, so when you email something after hours, the risk that some of us may not see it. So maybe in this case, just to say, send an SMS
yes.
to say the documents have been emailed, so that even those who might have closed their emails and whatever, then we go rush back.
The parliamentary office has noted that you will communicate the emails of the members to the drafters so that they could do so they can help. The SMS, yes. Yeah, I mean, the cell phone, yes. I mean, yes, yes.
Okay, Mayor, may I just ask that the committee clerk minutes our unhappiness with the rush by which this is being handled with, and the fact that there have been these sort of silly mistakes in the documentation that was presented to us does not instill any confidence that what we are going to be presented with on Wednesday morning will be without mistakes. And therefore, we would have preferred to have had ample time to study the documents that we are going to receive so that we could apply our minds, so that whatever we pass on Wednesday will be in a format that will not need this committee to amend the Act next year again. But as I sit here, I am convinced that the next amendment bill will be on its way just after Wednesday, after we've passed this one. Because I just feel that they, or believe that there have been too many mistakes made. And while the Director General is here as well, sir, we have said last week that we believe not only did we express our concerns about some of the things in the Act, but we are also concerned about some of the things which this bill unfortunately failed to address, such as the National Skills Fund, the National Skills Authority, the independence thereof, as well as the governance of the National Skills Fund. And we believe this is an opportunity lost to really apply our minds to really fix this bill. For the DG's benefit, last week one of the other members who isn't here this afternoon said there's an architectural problem, and we're now just trying to fix this bill by, you know, in my words, by just painting it another color. But our national skills development scenario needs a complete revision, which we believe you're busy addressing with your green paper process. But we believe that this bill, unfortunately, does not go far enough in terms of those requirements of your country. Thank you.
In closure, Honorable Van der Weyse is very radical, and I think I'll join him in that militancy to ensure that we exact a developmental state. We hope that the department will take that into cognizance, that we would like them to fast track the green paper process and ensure that we look into the heart of the issues that relate to skills development in the further legislative improvements that we would like to introduce. I should take this moment to thank members and officials for the expedition with which they executed the task of drafting and redrafting of the bill, and wish them more energy as more work comes their way. Thank you very much.
I just note with appreciation this do nada between yourself and the DA.
It's a strong relationship developing.
We are meeting G26 Wednesday, 9:30. G26 Wednesday, 9:30. G26, yes. Yes, thank you very much.